Welcome to another special edition of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, the author of C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. You're hearing the fifth of a six-part series called Exploring C.S. Lewis Misquotes and Misconceptions. Be sure to listen to the previous shows if you haven't already. You can follow the show notes for a direct link to them. If you have heard any of the earlier programs, then you know that I have a special guest host taking over shortly. In fact, we're going to let him go ahead and take over right now. Today, Reverend David Beckman returns to take over the helm. So welcome back to All About Jack, David.
Well, thanks, William. I'm sure I'm glad to be here with you again on this broadcast, and I look forward to our discussion.
Well, I'm going to have you give more details about yourself at the end of this episode, but briefly tell a few things and then lead us into this fifth show.
Well, William, I am an Anglican priest here in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I'm also the former warden of the kiln, C.S. Lewis's home in Oxford, England, and I've been the moderator of the C.S. Lewis Society of Chattanooga since 2005, and so I've had plenty of time to get to know people like yourself in the C.S. Lewis world, and I appreciate the work that you do to help people learn more about C.S. Lewis and his life and writings. Doing a good job. Thank you. Well, listen, William, today, as you said, we're going to be thinking about misconceptions about Lewis. In the initial show in this series, you gave an overview of the whole series, previewed the material. Second and third episodes, you had some quotations falsely attributed to Lewis, went through those. The last time about quotes that were either close to what Lewis wrote or he did write it. But out of context, so that it may not, you know, didn't mean necessarily what some people think it means. But today we're going to be thinking about misconceptions about C.S. Lewis, his life personally. And to begin, you know, I understand that you have a book planned that's going to cover a bunch of these misunderstandings. How many is it? 20 of them, is it?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah. And so we're only going to just be able to get into a couple. But tell me how you came up with this this interest in getting into these misconceptions.
Well, let me first say that first, I'm very excited at the time we are recording. Only a few weeks ago, I signed a contract for a book that will combine the material dealing with the misconceptions, a couple we're going to talk about today, and close to 20, you know, plus or minus, you know, it's a work in progress. So it's not over till it's over, and I'm sure there's probably more after I finish
it.
But anyway, and then it'll combine the earlier misquotes that we talked about in the show. So the regarding, though, the misconceptions in terms of how I got into it, I want to acknowledge that, you know, in addition to because of the work with the questionable quotations, a major influence to explore this topic came out of listening to a recording from Dr. Jerry Root, and he addressed a few misunderstandings about Lewis. I caught up with him subsequently after that, and he gave me a copy of his notes from that, and it included material that he didn't have time to completely address in that talk. I chatted with him about it, and so the plan is for him to do a forward for the book. In terms of involvement, wanted to have to do a co-author, but he's so busy with some other project, he was more than happy to have me kind of take over from where he was leaving off with this material from several years ago. So anyway, after hearing that talk and noting the different misconceptions, I was kept my ear open for other things that people maybe were saying online, or just from different things that I read in previous years that I didn't think much about. So that's how I came up with it. And so it's a really interesting topic to try to, you know, clarify things. It helped me clarify things in my own mind. So I thought, hey, let me put it together so others can benefit from some of the research that I did.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Lewis is such a popular guy. You know how it is. And people talk about other people. The stories can swell and change and so forth. And it's easy for misconceptions to creep up. Now, you've pre-selected two misconceptions that we're going to talk about today, but I understand that you've already got some material about this online, some other topics that you plan to address. What all is already available for us?
Right now, at the time of this recording, I've got only, I think, about six by the time this is posted. There might be even up to 12, depending on how busy I get. But, of course, the people who are listening to this later than the recording is going on right now, August of 2017, so that material may be even up by the time people are listening to it. But let me mention, I forgot from earlier, just a second ago, that for the book version, I'm going to be dividing it at the moment. This is the plan, is to explore things about his beliefs is one category, his relationships is the other, and then about his life and or writings is kind of the broad category.
Yeah. Yo, that's going to be really cool. A lot of interesting and diverse things you've got there. But again, today we're going to aim at just, let's see, not more than three. Hopefully we'll get through these two that we're going to look at today. So let's go ahead and jump in and think about the first misconception for today. And it has to do with Mrs. Moore, the lady that he lived with for so long. Why don't you summarize for us just who this Mrs. Moore was?
Certainly. Well, her full name is Janie King Askins Moore, and she was the mother of Patty Moore. This was one of Lewis's friends from World War I, where he actually met him before the war in terms of his preparation, before he served in that war, I guess I should say. Lewis and Mrs. Moore knew each other for over 30 years, and they spent most of that time living together. Now, when they first met, Janie was over 40 years old, while not divorced, was separated from her abusive husband for almost 10 years at the point when they met. Lewis was not yet 20 at the time. Patty Moore, who I just mentioned, he was Lewis's roommate at Keble College, Oxford, where they were in cadet training for World War I. Lewis first had a negative impression of Patty, interesting, but then in a letter from June 1917 to his father, he referenced him in a more positive light, and it's in this letter where we find the first mention of Mrs. Moore. She's only described very, very briefly, quote, an Irish lady, close quote. I don't know. You know, there's not much more brief that you can get than that. So if you, you know, look to his published letters, which were, you know, released after Lewis's death for a lot of detail about their eventual long-term relationship, then you're, you know, going to be disappointed. But now, among the clearest statements Lewis made about the relationship that we have in his letters is found in one from August the 27th, 1917, where he tells his father that he likes her immensely. The quote is, her immensely. Anyway, there may have been some things later in the letters, but that I might have missed. And, of course, there is always the possibility other letters will surface. I am aware of an assortment of letters that came about or came to light since the three volumes were published. But at this point, not too much from the letters that we can really glean.
Yeah, it's obvious that he really had a deep affection for her. In another letter during that same year, he was writing to his friend Arthur and said that he he does speak of Mrs. Moore, that the two of them were the two people that mattered most to him in all the world. So that's pretty interesting. So he wasn't just taking care of a friend's mother. You know, he really liked her. And of course, we don't want to give people the wrong impression. It wasn't just Lewis living alone with Mrs. Moore. Mrs. Moore had a daughter, Maureen, who was a young teenager. So they were, you know, the three of them were living together. But he lived with her for several decades. And, you know, by 1951 or so, when they were living in the kilns in Oxford, her health so deteriorated that she had to be moved into a nursing home. But even though that was the case, he still, you know, continued to visit with her daily, I believe. All that time, he seems to have kept up a good relationship with her. Of course, her daughter Maureen, they were, you know, Lewis and Maureen were lifelong friends too. But why is it now, we know that Mrs. Moore and Jack lived together, but just, you know, why was he living with her in the first place? How's that story go?
We have several places that we get the following information from, and that is that Lewis and Patty Moore, before they left their military training, they each made a pledge that if one didn't survive the war, that the other would take care of the other's parent. Now, this may seem unusual, you know, given that Lewis's father, Albert, wouldn't have really needed anyone to look after him. And Mrs. Moore had been living okay since she left her husband, you know, about 10 years before she even met Lewis. So while it's hard to understand while such a promise was made, Patty's sister remembers hearing about it, and there's a letter from Janie to Lewis's father from October the 1st, 1918, where she notes, quote, my poor son asked him to look after me if he did not come back, close quote. So this was written after Patty was declared missing in France and only about a month before he was confirmed dead.
Okay. All right. So they had this promise, and so when Patty did die in the war, he went to Mrs. Moore and began to take care of her and her daughter. So it was, like you say, a loyalty thing, as you understand. Okay. Well, now, you know, this was early on. This is like right around World War One. We know that Lewis, you know, continued to take care of her all the way until she died. But in the early 1930s, we know that there was a big change in Lewis's life. He becomes a Christian. How do you see that? Did that change in his life affect their relationship in any way, or you know, affect the setup? Have you got any comments about that?
Well, sure. Yeah, one of the things that I've heard you know, a lot of people say is, well, okay, well, so they were living together, but then, you know, Lewis becomes a Christian in the early 1930s. You know, he should have, like, just totally broken everything off. You know, these are people that lean more towards thinking that he did have an affair with her.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Such.
But you know, in terms of, you know, this, the whole big picture here is, you know, she did die like 20 years after this. And she went into a nursing home, though, about 9 months prior to that. So in terms of living with her, as you were noting about, there was the younger daughter. Warney also was living once they moved into the Kilns around this time as well. And so one of the things that does come to mind is that word loyalty. You know, it's one thing to, you know, make a promise, and then, you know, for a lot of people, they may keep a promise to a certain extent. But Lewis did have a good relationship with her, even though she maybe wasn't the easiest person to get along with. But one of the things that I do note in the article that I have posted online that I'm not going to talk too much about is in terms of what Lewis did learn from her. And one of the things that's pointed out in several biographies is about hospitality. It's noted that he did learn from her. So, yeah, I mean, so overall, what sticks out in my mind, instead of, you know, going, what if, or, you know, did he do this, or, you know, maybe he did have a sexual relationship with her early on, or he was at least infatuated with her, but later on, that would have obviously changed after he had become a Christian. I note this more in the article that I have posted online, and that is Lewis, you know, would be one that lived out his Christian faith to the fullest. And so we would know that if there was anything going on relationally in terms of an affair, that that would have been broken off. But anyway, so, you know, overall here, we do know also that he often referred to Mrs. Moore as his mother to others. And, you know, when you make a pledge to your friend, which he did early on, then he, you know, stuck with it. And that commitment is very much important. So while we, you know, haven't really directly talked about this, you know, affair question, it is interesting to note that before she moved into the nursing home, her and Lewis, along with Lewis's brother, Warney, lived in the house together for nearly 20 years. So as, you know, again, trying to get a big picture, this isn't just, okay, Lewis lived with this lady by himself. No, that's not what it was. And yes, she never did divorce the guy she was married to, which from what others have said, that's not too uncommon in terms of that error. But anyway, it's, you know, it's hard to imagine in terms of noting with the other people around, but, you know, having a secret affair with, you know, the younger daughter there, and then the his older brother and such. So it's just really hard to imagine.
So I think the picture that I see you painting here is that early on, like after the war and in the early 1920s and so forth, when it was just Jack and Mrs. Moore and Maureen, that his close ties to Mrs. Moore at that time could have had a romantic bent to it. But then and by the time he becomes a Christian, well, to begin with, I mean, you know, natural process would have taken place. I mean, they would have been living together for some time, and she's approaching her 60s or whatever, and he's getting older. And so you can see how naturally their relationship would tend to, you know, calm down, as it were, and maybe be more of a mother-son thing. And then with his Christianity, you've got that added element that you're emphasizing of his the loyalty of his character, and how, regardless of you know, how things had gone, yet he is going to be living out this commitment to this woman because of his Christian commitments. And then early on, you know, back in the early days, I know Maureen said that on Sundays, sometimes Jack and Mrs. Moore would try to be sure that she went to church so they could have some time alone together mm-hmm. at the flat. But, you know, once they move into the Kilns, and there's a whole mess of people all over the place there all the time. It was like a dormitory, so to speak. It was a really different situation. So I see that you've got a number of arguments there that, you know, whatever may have been going on earlier years, yet, you know, when you hit the 30s, it's a mother-son situation, and Jack is just being faithful to this woman that he, you know, loves like a mother, and also because he's keeping his promise to Patty.
Well, exactly, yeah. So, you know, at the very least, as we already were saying here earlier, is that Lewis was probably infatuated. And, you know, what 19-year-old wouldn't have some romantic interest in a older lady? Now, being a friend's mother, that makes it kind of unusual there. But yeah, at the very least, he probably, you know, had that. In terms of, I was noting to you before we started recording, I was reviewing some material, and Ian Wilson's biography says the burden of proof lies for people to prove that Lewis didn't have a sexual relationship. But we take the opposite perspective, that the burden of proof lies in the other direction and such. And so, you know, it's, again, if there was anything, once he had become a Christian, that would have been clearly broken off because of Lewis's Christian commitment. Some of that I elaborate more in the article online. So we encourage people. I don't know if we said the website. It's EssentialCSLewis.com.
Yeah, they can go to EssentialCSLewis.com and read some of the more details that you have about Lewis's relationship with Mrs. Moore. But we need to, as time is flying along here, we need to move on to another topic. Let's talk about the claim that C.S. Lewis had a serious crisis of faith after he lost a debate with somebody. And he suffered so much from it that he stopped defending the faith altogether. Why don't you set the stage for us by telling who it was he debated and why, and along with where it was.
Sure. So, yeah, the claim is that on February, or it's not a claim, but the event happened February the 2nd, 1948, and the claim is that Lewis suffered defeat at a debate held at the Oxford Socratic Club, and this was a group that he was president of. This club was an organization at Oxford University. It was formed to debate and discuss issues related to the Christian faith. The person that he debated, which we'll talk about, it wasn't really a debate, but Elizabeth Anscrum is was a Catholic believer who was not yet 30 at the time, and she questioned a specific aspect in the book Miracles, a Preliminary Study. This book was released in May 1947, and the aspect that she questioned is very technical. Many Lewis scholars I've talked with don't claim to even have a full picture of it because it is very, very specific, and it's something that can be of interest to some, but not to others. So we're not going to go into that aspect. But in terms of the, you know, was it a debate? Well, what it is that Anscrum actually presented a paper, and Lewis responded to it, and then the two of them discussed the issue. And there was an open discussion before the end of the meeting. So for a lot of people, in terms of when you think of a debate, this is not what the average person will think of. Most think of a debate in terms of what you might see between candidates for a political office.
Mm-hmm.
So now, after that meeting, there was an official report of it, which is why we know so much about it. And it's it was in something that's called the Socratic Digest that was available not that long after the event, within the first couple of years. And then this went out of print, but then it was collected not that long ago. And so when you look at what was written at the time, no one was declared a winner or anything. But we do know in terms of this debate that, if you still want to call it a debate, because in one sense it was, but in what most people popularly think about. But yeah. Elizabeth Anscrum did at least match wits with Lewis in a way that's rarely seen. In other words, Lewis was just so good at his rhetorical skills, and he was very familiar with a lot of issues. He had a good grasp on a wide range of topics, and so he was rarely even matched wits with, and this is something that definitely did happen. So, you know, saying that each person did equally well sounds like a cop-out, but that's probably the best way to characterize it.
Yeah, it's my understanding that after the debate, someone asked Dr. Anscombe about upsetting Lewis, and she said, I had no idea that I'd said anything to bother him. You know, it was like, this was a non-issue thing. Of course, we know that Lewis also, being the humble man that he was, he picked up on some of the notes she made, and he adjusted his book, that particular portion. But, it's interesting, though, that some people have tried to argue that because there was this unusual situation where somebody actually was able to sort of correct Lewis a little bit, that somehow he had this great, despair about being an apologist anymore, and he published fewer materials directly related to the Christian faith. But what's the truth behind that?
All right, well, there's a couple of different angles that we can look at. I'm going to choose only to look at the actual books. I mentioned Dr. Jerry Root earlier. He has an excellent piece online where he talks about articles that Lewis wrote, if you consider that and such, and that's a very good angle as well. But I haven't seen anyone like break down in terms of the before and after for his books itself, and so I went through that. And so, the first thing that came to my mind is, if he did not publish as many books specifically on Christian topics, would that necessarily prove the reason was because of what happened at the Socratic Club? I obviously don't think so. But now, while the 1950s for Lewis will be remembered primarily as the decade that the Narnia stories were published, now let's explore, what books Lewis did publish before this encounter, and then after that encounter until... And you made reference to it. He did do a revision of the book Miracles, and that came out in May of 1960. So I broke it down, and I'm going to first consider, what happened after the debate? Well, when you only consider the books, you find that there were 8 fictional books, 3 academic titles, and then 6 related more directly to Christian topics. And I go into more detail in terms of some aspects about that in the article I have online. So again, these are books that came out after the 1948 encounter, or we might just refer to it simply as the debate, up until 1960. Now, of course, Lewis wrote several books before he died in 63, but we're kind of capping it off at that point in terms of when the revised version of Miracles came out. So in some ways, it's like, well, wait a minute, didn't I just, go against my own point? 8 fictional books, 3 academic titles, and 6 books more directly related to Christian topics. But then, let's look at what happened before the debate in terms of what was published. Now, if you exclude the 2 poetry books that Lewis wrote before he became a Christian, you find that there were 6 fictional titles written between 1933 and 1948. That's only 2 less than the span between the infamous debate and the revised edition of Miracles. Thus, he was, already using fiction as a means to explore issues in an imaginative way.
Right.
Then there's actually 4 academic titles before the debate. And then we could say there were 6 nonfiction titles on books that were related to Christian topics prior to this 1948 showdown. But then some of Lewis's books are kind of hard to categorize because they kind of cross over, because within mm-hmm. this 6, one of them is more technically an academic book than a Christian book, if you really think about it, and that title is The Abolition of Man, which mm-hmm. is based on 3 lectures he gave in 1943. Thus, you can actually say that Lewis wrote more directly Christian themes works after the encounter than before the encounter with Anscombe's. And I'm considering doing a visual chart to this in my book. We don't have that on the online article, but
that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. I do encourage people to, take a look at the article. Once my book comes out, I'm not sure how much the publisher is going to let me keep up in terms online about the material. It may be only about the equivalent of what we're sharing now, but mm-hmm. I thought at this stage we want to, get the word out about some different things regarding Lewis to help clear up the picture about things. And this is one of those areas that is definitely confusing to people in terms of what really happened. And one of the things, I did clearly say, but people think in terms of a debate, you usually have someone that's on the opposite side of an issue in a total sense. So many people falsely assume that Anscombe wasn't a Christian, but she was. She was a Catholic believer, so this wasn't, extreme issues. There were no extreme positions in terms of, hey, as a non-believer, I think you did a bad job explaining this. This is someone saying, hey, here's some ways that you were thinking about it. I don't believe it's the best way of presenting it. Lewis considered it. He later revised. But he was in no rush to revise if you, you know, consider the fact that 1947 was when the book came out. The debate happened less than a year. And then 1960 was when he revised it. And between this time, and I don't even think I included this in the article online, but I will in the book, and that is there actually was a abridged version of Miracles that was released. Lewis approved of the abridgment, and there was no revision to that chapter, which was chapter 3 of the book Miracles. So a lot of things to consider about that. It's not a simple issue, but when you look at it in a clear picture, then it becomes more easily understood about, you know, what actually happened.
Yeah, you're really spot on about that. She was entirely behind his thesis. It's just that she was disagreeing with the way he was stating some things. And I think that chart that you're thinking you're proposing would be good, because I like how you do that, and that you show that his output on both sides of the timeline of the debate is pretty equal there. And, you know, I also think about how it is that a lot of people who apparently people who say, well, Lewis turned away from doing apologetics and started writing children's stories, started writing fiction. They're not understanding what those Narnia stories were. You know, they were exactly. They were serious Christian apologetics. It's just that they were presented in an imaginative way instead of a scholarly way. And he didn't stop at all. He just changed tack and just went on.
Right. He changed the way in which he presented it. And again, this wasn't like, oh, I'll just suddenly start using fiction to convey my Christian faith or to convey aspects of Christianity. He was already doing that.
That's right.
So it's real interesting when people kind of look at it in an oversimplistic way.
It is. Well, listen, William, I'm sorry, but we're running out of time here. Now, the next episode is going to be the sixth and final episode of this series, I believe. Mm-hmm. And you're going to do one more misconception. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Next time I'm going to look at whether or not Lewis held beliefs that were consistent with a universalist, which is, of course, believing that everybody goes to heaven. So that's going to be explored next time. As well as going to be wrapping up. In fact, let me, though, take a second here, and that is earlier I had planned, but I didn't get a chance to mention or didn't take the time, and that is in terms of other type of topics dealing with Lewis misconceptions. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do this in the next podcast. I'll have material online, and then it'll be available subsequently in the book, but I have planned to tackle the issue of whether or not Lewis believed in evolution. Was Lewis against science? Was Lewis a fundamentalist? Did Lewis hate women? Was Lewis, and the following are a little bit more minor issues, but it's sometimes things somewhat confusing. Was he an Oxford professor? He wasn't, but what was he there? And then one that I've never heard anyone else kind of cover, it sounds a little confusing. I'm claiming that Lewis is not reading the book of the Four Loves when you hear the audio version. It's actually his voice, but he's not reading the book. And so I did that article is already posted online about that. And mm-hmm. then one that even established Lewis scholars have repeated that is not true, and that Lewis was not the second most recognized voice after Winston Churchill. So I have an article about that. So, you know, there's a variety of things that are misunderstood about Lewis, some more serious than others, but we try to be thorough about it. So that's those issues are online. Hopefully by the time people hear this, the majority of them are. But since we're recording in early August 2017, you know, be patient if you're listening early on. But that stuff will be eventually available. But yeah, hopefully the two topics we did talk about today about Mrs. Moore and about the debate with Anscombe was helpful for people.
Well, that all sounds great, William. And listen, thanks again for having me on as a guest host. It was fun.
All right. Well, before you go, David, let me go ahead and have you take a few more minutes to tell us about yourself. But actually, I need to not forget that we do have a sponsor, and that sponsor is Shelley & Son Books. You can find Shelley & Son Books online at shelleyandsonbooks.com. They specialize in rare books by Lewis Tolkien and the Inklings and Friends. You can order by their website, phone, or email. They accept a variety of payments. You can browse and search their catalog online. Again, that is ShelleyandSonBooks.com. So, David, let's hear some more details about yourself.
Well, I do some blogging. I blog about Lewis stuff, but other things as well at RevBeckman.com. And by the way, my last name is spelled with two N's on the end. So you got, don't put that second N there. You won't get it. So that's RevBeckman.com. I've also got a video course on Letters to Malcolm that I recorded a year ago, just a year ago and maybe a week or two over in Oxford around the Kilns and where Lewis lived. It's about eight or so sessions trying to help people understand, you know, the basic content and to explain some things about Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. And there's a link to that on RevBeckman.com. And I've also got a book now. It's called Truth to Life, Turning Doctrine into Devotion. And you can find that on Amazon.com. That's Truth to Life by David Beckman. And otherwise, I'll just keep following along, William, and seeing what else you're going to come up with next.
Thank you also as the listener for joining us for this special edition of Exploring Misquotes and Misconceptions. This All About Jack podcast is a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix podcast network. And let me give you a quick reminder that this episode is sponsored by Shelley and Son Books. You can find Shelley and Son Books online at ShelleyandSonBooks.com. Shelley is spelled S-H-E-L-L-E-Y. Don't forget to check the show notes for links to material mentioned in the show today, along with links to my guest host for the show. You can find those show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com. Just look for the All About Jack podcast episode number 5 here for the Lewis misquotes and misconceptions. But you also can locate the show notes where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. If you found this show later than when it was released, in September 2017, then you can head on over to EssentialCSLewis.com, my main website, to hear the next episode. Otherwise, you can wait for about a week if you're listening to it as it was originally released. Let me also mention that since I recorded this show with David, plans changed regarding my forthcoming book. So as of September 2017, I will just be doing a book on quotations or the misquotes. And then so the material related to the misconceptions, which was the focus for today, that will be published at a date that's yet to be determined. The misquotes book is due out by May 2018. The reason for this is because after further research, I was able to uncover at least 60 expressions that are questionable. And so while that won't make for a large book, it should mean I have enough material for around a 150-page book. Before ending, I want to remind you as well that I have a book that is an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters. It's called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. You can learn more about that book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Purchasing the book is a great way to help support this free podcast. And before I go, let me again thank you for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.